The title of Brother Jesse's first class is The Runner, and he has asked us to read in connection with that class from the book of Jonah, chapter 1, verses 1 through 7. We'll ask Brother Josh Budney to come forward and lead us in that reading.
Jonah 1, verses 1 through 7. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me." But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. Then the mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God, and they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came and said to him, "What do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give a thought to us that we may not perish." And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us." So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah.
Please give your kind and careful attention now to our brother Jesse as he begins his study of Jonah with class number 1, The Runner. Brother Jesse.
Hey, Brother David, and good afternoon, brothers and sisters and young people. You know, if I had to say, really, the two things which Christadelphians are commonly known for, in your mind, what might you say? And, you know, hopefully we're people of the book, number one. But we do enjoy our food, number two. And I think it's quite remarkable and sort of refreshing in a way. We've actually begun the study weekend with a meal. And so I think that meal was superb, and I think it's got Book Road on notice. So I'll have to bring back some thoughts and some innovations to our potluck meals we have back in Hamilton. But now, of course, we're going to be looking into God's Word, sort of the spiritual food, as it were. Now, brothers and sisters, young people, we've made our way down from Hamilton, a lovely trip, about 5 hours or so, and left your brothers and sisters at the Hamilton Book Road Ecclesia, of many you have probably met in person, and it's such a wonderful thing to be able to travel, you know, great distances, and still be able to meet and interact with those that love the Word of God, that are eagerly anticipating His kingdom. And that's what we're going to consider this weekend as we look at Prophet Jonah. I think if your experience is anything like mine growing up, you have a Sunday school, you learn sort of the pinnacle Sunday school stories, right? And what are those pinnacle, you know, foundation Sunday school stories that you're taught sort of as a young boy or a young girl? And you might think, okay, you know, Adam and Eve in the garden, creation. And you move on, maybe Noah and the account of the great flood. You move a little further and you look at characters like David and Goliath and, you know, the great battle that he had to overcome against the giant of the Philistines. Perhaps a few more. You look at Daniel in the lion's den. That's a classic, that one. And the list goes on. Samson, right? The strong man. And all those sort of pinnacle Sunday school stories. And I think it's safe to say that Jonah is one of those sort of quintessential Sunday school stories that you just happen to learn as a young boy or a young girl. Now, if your experience is anything like mine, I'm going to assume that it was, we know this story of Jonah, don't we? He runs away from God. He has a mission to fulfill. He doesn't want to do it. He gets swallowed by a whale. He ends up going to Nineveh. He's pretty sulky towards the end of the book. It's a pretty good summation of the whole story of Jonah. But you see, when we consider a Sunday school story, I particularly like these types of studies because you think, oh, I know everything there is to know about that Sunday school story and have known it for a long time. I think by the time we walk away from this study, just in 5 simple classes, you'll think there's much more that there is to know about a Sunday school story. And we're going to endeavor to do that this weekend with the character of Jonah. Because I want you to think in your mind for just a minute. You think about Jonah. Think about what we know about Jonah before we even sort of crack the spine on the book, this minor prophet. Now, Jonah was very narrow-minded. He was a very insular individual. He made impetuous decisions, but they were calculated in some way. Jonah was hasty to get angry, very upset.
And Jonah ultimately rejected the will of God and decided that he was going to usurp that will with his own. And that's Jonah, really, in a nutshell. Jonah is going to be laid really bare in front of us with all his faults and all his warts. But as we sort of come to consider this character of Jonah, we're going to see ourselves in him. We're going to see the times in our lives where we are just like Jonah. We're going to see the failures that we have, much like he had. But there's also going to be times in Jonah where he had great successes, and he changed his mind, and he repented unto God, and we're going to see ourselves in those moments too. But then, God willing, tomorrow in a memorial exhortation, we're going to conclude the story of Jonah really on a cliffhanger. How does it really end for him? And I think it's designed that way to make us go away and think, how would it end for us? What would we be like if we found ourselves in the position that Jonah found himself? It's the conclusion of his little minor prophet book. Now, how we're going to study the book of Jonah is in five classes, and I've sort of titled them this way, just really more of a main theme of the different portions of Jonah. So this morning we're going to consider the runner. When Jonah gets the commandment to go to Nineveh, he's going to turn and go the opposite way. But then God is going to find him in the midst of the sea and cause a big storm, and he's going to have to make a decision where he thereby delivers the Gentiles in class number two. Then in that sort of infamous prayer, it says that he prayed unto God, he's going to proclaim the mercy of God, though undeserved, for Jonah. And that's it for today. And then God willing, tomorrow, he's going to be the messenger. He's going to step foot into Nineveh. He's going to fulfill that vow. He's going to proclaim salvation to Gentile individuals. And then finally, in our memorial meeting, our exhortation, we'll look at Jonah the observer as he goes and sits and waits to see what would become of the city of Nineveh that he had preached to. And here this morning, what we're going to look at in this class is, well, who was Jonah? We'll look at where he came from, where he hailed from, what he did and prophesied. You know, why did Jonah flee? We have to answer that question. And then we're also going to look at, well, where did the Lord find Jonah? And then we'll have some exhortations scattered throughout as well. Now, when we look at Jonah chapter 1 in verse 1, so we're going to look for us, and we look at verse 1, it sort of starts in that typical fashion. So you look at verse 1 of Jonah chapter 1, it says, "Now the word of the Lord came unto Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying." So right away we get a little bit of information on Jonah. If you have a Bible marking pencil, I encourage you to make some notes into your margins. It's highly effective for usage later. So we find out that Jonah had a father, and we even know his father's name, and it was Amittai. So here's what we have, just on some definitions. Many of us will know that Jonah's name means a dove. And his father, Amittai, it means truth. And so here's a son of truth. And this is remarkable because right away we're told that this is Jonah's name. He's a dove, sort of a clean animal, and he's a son of truth. You see, why it's important is we're going to see, is Jonah going to stack up, and is he going to be able to live up to that? Is he going to walk in truth? Is he going to tell the truth? Right? And is that going to be the guiding influence in his own life? So here is Jonah, the dove, the son of Amittai, who means the truth. Now you see that there's a verse there. He prophesied during the reign of Jeroboam II. So if you can, just come with me to 2 Kings chapter 14. And this is really sort of an introductory remark, almost a prelude, if you will, in 2 Kings 14 to the prophet of Jonah. It's really important to sort of get some context and background of when he was actually prophesying in 2 Kings 14. We're here in the reign of Jeroboam II. And Jeroboam II reigned for a considerable amount of time, 41 years exactly. And so we read in 2 Kings 14, verse 23, it says, "In the 15th year of Amaziah," 2 Kings 14, verse 23, "the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam," and Jeroboam II that is, "the son of Joash, king of Israel, began to reign in Samaria and reigned 41 years." So Jeroboam II reigned 41 years, and we notice where he reigned from. He reigned from Samaria. So right away we know he's a king in the northern kingdom of Israel. But it goes on in verse 24. "And Jeroboam did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, And he departed not from all the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, one of his predecessors, who made Israel to sin. And he restored the coast of Israel from the entering of Hamath unto the sea of the plain, according to the word of the Lord God of Israel, which he spake by the hand of his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, which was of Gath Hepher. So what we just read there is that Jonah is around the time of Jeroboam II, within the 41-year span. And in verse 25, Jonah would have been a highly favored prophet. And why do we say that? Because he said that Israel's borders would actually expand. Right? And we're told there that he's from the city called Gath Hepher. So there it is on the screen, the definition. And Gath Hepher means the winepress of the well. So we take a little symbolic elements out of that. And a winepress of the well. So the water of this well is producing a fruit that can go in a winepress. You know, so we have a little bit of, you know, some imagery here that's going on. You know, Jonah's a dove, a clean animal, the son of truth. He's from Gath Hepher, which sort of uses the water of God's word and produces a fruit. And so this is our introduction to Jonah. One verse. And Jonah is a great prophet. He's an upstanding citizen in Israel. And God is using him as a vocal piece that he can say to Jeroboam, your coasts are going to extend from Hamath even unto the sea of the plain. And so what we learn about Jonah, Gath Hepher, that it was actually a city way up in the north in the tribe of Zebulun. And just to sort of give you some distances, and I've tried to put miles here because Americans are still catching up, but they're located about 5 kilometers or 3 miles northwest of Nazareth, home of the prophet Jonah, Joshua 19:13. That's where we find out that Gath Hepher was in Zebulun. And by extension, being 110 kilometers or 68 miles north of Jerusalem. So up here is Gath Hepher. This is where Jonah was from. There's a little geographical marker there with Jerusalem. And this is where Jonah made his home, way up there in Gath Hepher. Now, furthermore, there's a little visual representation of all the reigns of the kings. So in red, the very far left-hand side, you had the United Kingdom of Israel and Judah, right? Saul, David, Solomon. And then you come through, the green is the kingdom of Judah, and the blue is the kingdom of Israel. So you come all the way to Jeroboam II here, and 41 years he reigned, and you notice he reigned the longest in all the northern kingdom of Israel. 41 years. So it's quite a long time that that Jeroboam II was upon the throne. And we're eventually, God willing, going to pinpoint when we think Jonah was actually given the prophecy to go to Nineveh. So if you come back with me to Jonah, the book of Jonah, we sort of just had a little bit of context there with Jonah and the words that he was given to be a prophet. Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying. And you see, Jonah had prophesied something that the people of Israel would have been very happy to hear about. Because when we see what he actually prophesied, there was a great enlarging of the land of Israel. And so here you have Samaria, the capital. But Jonah said all the way from Hamath to the Sea of the Plain, and many believe it's the Sea of Arabah, just south of the Dead Sea there. This was the geographical height of the kingdom of Israel under Jeroboam II. So it would have been a really prosperous time for Israel to have this enlarging of their borders. So Jonah had a reputation that went ahead of him when we consider 2 Kings chapter 14. But when we come back to Jonah, Jonah chapter 1 and verse 2, you notice what came into the ear of Jonah. He's already accomplished these great feats in Israel. But the word of the Lord came unto Jonah. And you see Jonah chapter 1 and verse 2. Arise and go to Nineveh. And so you just imagine, you know, here's Jonah. He's maybe at his desk and he's pondering something. And all of a sudden a little tap on his ear. Yeah, Jonah, I want you to go to Nineveh. And you can just imagine Jonah saying, I'm sorry. Did you just say Nineveh? Yes, I said Nineveh. You can just imagine Jonah thinking, Nineveh? Why would I ever want to go to Nineveh? Well, the rest of verse 2 says, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness is come up before me. So it wasn't go to Nineveh and sort of give them a comforting message. You know, Nineveh, you're on the right track to potentially, you know, being a spiritually minded kingdom. No, it was go to Nineveh and say, you're in big trouble. You're wicked. There's corrective measures that need to be instituted within your kingdom. Now, think about it in our own lives, brothers and sisters and young people. Have you ever had to go to maybe, you know, your friend or an individual and sort of give them a little bit of corrective advice? You know, how do you feel? Your palms get sweaty. You feel anxious. You know, are they gonna hate me for life if I say something that's, you know? And we have to put ourselves in the shoes of Jonah now. So we're really kind of coming into the mind of Jonah. Not only does he have to go to Nineveh, of all places, one of the enemies of Israel, but he's not going to give a comforting message, as it were. He's going to have to say, look, there are areas in your life which you need to improve upon. And he's going to have to do this and obey the commandments of God. Not only that, but it wasn't just a hop, skip, and a jump away. So when we actually consider the great city of Nineveh, what we have there is Nineveh means the abode of Venus, which is a pagan god. And Nineveh was from where Jonah was located, about 700 miles from Jerusalem. So, you know, if you took a direct flight, which they didn't have, you could get there faster. But Jonah would have had to sort of go around and stay close to the waterways. So they estimate that the distance is about 700 miles. That's quite a considerable distance. We're talking, you know, a matter of probably 30 days just to even get to Nineveh. So this is not sort of going to the grocery store for a bag of milk. This is a big commitment for Jonah to do this. Also we have Nineveh worship the fertility goddess Ishtar. So we get the Ishtar gates from this as well. So they're definitely a pagan nation. And in Genesis 10, verse 11, it was founded by Nimrod. Nimrod of all people. He says he was a mighty hunter in the face of God. He didn't care about God. I'll do what I want. And he certainly did what he wanted. And so when Jonah is sort of receiving the message that he has to go to Assyria, this is big business. This is a considerable engagement and a commitment level that Jonah has to lift up to. Now, I want to give you four sort of verses you can tuck in your margin somewhere. This is what Assyria was known as in the time of Jonah, okay? So four things. Here's the first one. In 2 Kings 16, verse 7 and 9, they were known as a mercenary. Now, what's a mercenary? Well, a mercenary you could hire out to sort of do your bidding, you know? So you have an enemy you want to take care of. Well, you could knock on the door of Assyria, pay them a large sum, and they would take care of your enemy. So it was almost like a hitman. So they were known as a mercenary in 2 Kings 16, verse 7 and 9. In 2 Kings 19, verse 17, they were known as a destroyer. So they were very good at what they did. They were, you might even say, last year, they were the Pittsburgh Penguins of military might, right? They definitely weren't the Toronto Maple Leafs, I can say that. But they were the best at what they did, is really what that analogy is supposed to show, right? 2 Kings 19, verse 17. They would get the job done and they would do it successfully. How about this one? We're going to find out in Jonah 3 and verse 8, some of their own words, that they were in fact aggressors. So they didn't just sit back and wait for the enemy to come to them. They often would be the instigators of evil. And they would actually possess that sort of aggressive attitude. Jonah 3, verse 8. And finally, the fourth one that we have, so we're known as a robber. You see, it says in Nahum 3, verse 1, which is so highly focused on the city of Nineveh and the Assyrian Empire, but anything that went into Nineveh didn't escape. And they were known as a robber. In fact, I want you to come with me, so you might tuck those in your margin somewhere, but just come with me to Nahum, which is just a little bit forward. Come with me to Nahum chapter 3.
Here is really that quintessential verse which characterizes Assyria, and the heartbeat of Assyria really at that time was Nineveh. So we come to Nahum chapter 3, and here's where we read just at verse 1. So notice the two things that they're known for in Nahum chapter 3 and verse 1. It says, "Woe to that bloody city," speaking of Nineveh, "it is all full of lies and robbery." So the two things that Nineveh was known for was lies and robbery. And if that wasn't enough, at the very end of verse 1 of Nahum 3, "the prey departeth not." And so, I don't know if there's any hunters here. There might be some hunters in our midst here. But you have you have that animal lined up in your sight, and you know the moment of pulling the trigger, that animal's yours. It's not escaping. And this was the thing with Nineveh. Anything that went in there, it was almost as if they were being caught like a prey. And so now I want you to sort of come back with me to Jonah. You know, your ears are ringing, and God has said, "I want you to go to this city." I had to do a little bit of homework on this. Thank Brother Stephen for this. But you have some areas in Pittsburgh. But at a certain time of day and the sun goes down, you probably wouldn't want to be out on the streets. And if I'm saying right, the Hill District. Is that right, Brother Stephen? The Hill District. You familiar with the Hill District around here, Pittsburgh? Maybe there's a few other areas, very shady. Shady dealings. And I want you to think back to your own homes, wherever you come, there's a few Ohioans. How do you say it?
Ohioans.
A few Ohioans. A few Ontarians. You know, where I live now in Hamilton, there's the mountain, the bump, and then there's the city. Okay? It's all Hamilton. But I've only lived in Hamilton since 2010, born and raised in Brampton. But I know that if you go down to the city and you go north of Barton Street, you might want to be careful, you know, certainly at nighttime. You know, locking the door is not really good enough, as they say. And I know that in Hamilton, okay? So what do you think in your own sort of vicinity where you hail from? Is there a little location that sort of shady area, that if God said to you, "I want you to go and do some leafleting there," you might say, "I should probably get a bulletproof jacket," and then maybe, you'd be really hesitant. So here's what's going on in Jonah's mind. But you see, for Jonah, there's some other things at play, and we're going to be looking at those in Jonah's mind. Not only there's a factor of, physical violence, right, with Nineveh, but there's also going to be a spiritual element which is going to pervade his mind as to why it is that he's hesitant to do this. Now, Unger's Bible Dictionary, quite good, and it has this to say about the Assyrian Empire at the time of Noah, or Jonah, pardon me. It says, "Speaking of the bloody empire, in stature the Assyrians were of average modern European height and were well built. Their complexion was dark, the nose prominent, the hair, eyebrows, and beard thick and bushy. But they are apparently of cheerful disposition, given to mirth and feasting, but of implacable cruelty. The pages of history are nowhere more bloody than in the records of their wars." And that's saying something. You know, all the histories of the empires that have gone on, here was Assyria, and they were sort of, the creme de la creme, for all the wrong reasons, as it were. Here we go on here. It says, "Assyria was the most ferocious of them all. Their very name became a byword for cruelty and for atrocity. They skinned their prisoners alive and cut off various body parts to inspire terror in their enemies. There is records of Assyrian officials pulling out tongues and displaying mounds of human skulls, all to bring about stark horror and wealthy tribute from surrounding nations." Yeah, how about that, eh? A little bit of a decor in the alleyways and the corridors of the city of Nineveh and of Assyria at large. You know, there's a tongue there, there's a skull there. Oh, I wonder what those are for, etc. So here's the mind of Jonah. I have to go into this city, the heartbeat of this empire. And the message that I'm bringing with me is, what all this says you're all about, it's got to change. So now think, go into that little area, that little nook of your sort of city or town, wherever you're from, and say, you're going to go into the heart of that area, and you're going to say, here's a pamphlet on why you need forgiveness. And as you're handing that pamphlet, shaking like a leaf, right? Well, this is what's going on in Jonah's mind. So now we're really coming into the mindset of Jonah, at least on a physical level. And it says there in Jonah chapter 1 and verse 2, the second half of verse 2, it says, for their wickedness is come up before me. And so they were well known for their wickedness. But look what it says in verse 3. But Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish, from the presence of the Lord. And so what we actually find is that Jonah is going to flee. He's going to take his own will and usurp the will of God. We don't do that, do we, brothers and sisters and young people? We don't take God's will and replace it with our own, do we? And you see, we do that, don't we? We all know that we do that. Because really, to satisfy sin is really to be selfish. It's to take what God has said and say, well, I'm going to do what I think. And so here what we have with Jonah is he's going to usurp God's will with his own, and he's going to flee unto Tarshish. Now the divided kingdom of Israel, by R. Peter Meyer, page 95, says this: Jonah, the prophet of Israel, was not prepared to extend God's mercy to Assyria. And not only did he despise the Assyrians, but he resented the idea that Israel's God would be concerned about the people of a foreign nation. You see, now we're going to get into the sense that it wasn't just the physical qualities. It was also the spiritual qualities of Nineveh. You know, they were Israel's enemy in more ways than one. And so Jonah's actually going to flee. You see what it says there in verse 3? Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. Now, I'm going to give you just a few examples in the Bible of those that fled from the presence of the Lord. And I'm going to give you four again, okay? So if you want to write them down. I'm going to suggest that the reasons why individuals flee from the presence of the Lord is because they're stubborn. And we're going to just look at these four individuals. You see, in Genesis 4, verse 16, we can flee from the presence of the Lord because we're stubborn like Cain. You see, in the incident with Cain and his brother Abel, God extended to Cain a way to seek forgiveness. But Cain couldn't forgive himself. See, the punishment was greater than he could bear. And he couldn't actually bring himself to humble himself and actually seek that forgiveness. So he fled from the presence of the Lord. Genesis 4, verse 16. Now how about this one in 1 Samuel 16, verse 14? We can be stubborn like Saul, and we can't forgive God. And, you know, you say that phrase, can't forgive God. God has never needed to be forgiven of anything. But man, in certain circumstances, they feel that God has mistreated them. And in the instance of 1 Samuel 16, verse 14, when God troubled Saul to bring Saul back into the confines of the way of righteousness, Saul couldn't forgive him, couldn't forgive God, and so he fled from his presence. How about this one in Job 1, verse 7 and 12? You know, we can flee from the presence of God and be stubborn like the Satan because we couldn't forgive the truth. You see, the Satan in Job, he came with the sons of God, he came to the memorial meetings, you know, he came in before, presented himself to the Lord. But something about the way of the truth, he would just rather up and down, to and fro within the earth, and do what I want. And any individual who was an upstanding character in the truth couldn't forgive. So he fled from the presence of the Lord. And finally here, in Jonah 1, verse 3, we can be stubborn like Jonah, and flee the presence of the Lord, because we can't forgive others. You think in our own lives, have we ever had someone wrong us? Maybe said some harsh words which we found out later? Maybe even done something to us? Maybe rubbed us the wrong way too many times? And in our heart of hearts, we actually can't forgive them. You see, with Jonah here in Jonah chapter 1 and verse 3, when it says that he fled from the presence of the Lord, it's because he couldn't bear to think that other individuals outside of Israel would be able to receive the forgiveness of God. And so, what does he do? He's going to flee from God's presence, foolishly. So it says in verse 1 of Jonah 3, verse 3 of Jonah 1, Jonah rose up to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord and went down to Joppa. He found a ship going to Tarshish, so he paid the fare thereof, and went down into it to go with them unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And you notice there, you can't help but notice in verse 3, you know, Jonah went down to Joppa. He went down into the boat. And then you notice in the end of verse 5, that when Jonah got into the boat, but Jonah was gone down into the sides of the ship. So we just, by underlining the words down, down, and down. You know, Jonah is going spiritually down, even as he's going physically down. You know, Jonah is making these deliberate decisions. Because also we note that he's deliberately choosing this way. Because in verse 3, Jonah rose up to flee. He found a ship. He took out his wallet and paid the fare. There's no accidents here. This is a deliberate decision making. Now, do we ever deliberately flee the presence of God and disobey his orders and commands? You know, say that so, but it probably does happen in our own lives. We know what we should do. I'm going to do it this way. You see, this is exactly what's going on with Jonah. He is deliberately taking these actions upon himself, and he is not upholding the will of God for his own life. So as Jonah is descending deeper into the bowels of the ship, you see what it says in verse 4? But the Lord sent out a great wind, and there was a mighty tempest in the sea, so that the ship was like to be broken. Now when it says there in verse 4 that there was a tempest in the sea, the word tempest, it means a hurricane. So this is not a sort of a little storm on a little pond. This is a hurricane. And when it says that it was sent out, also in verse 4, it says, but the Lord sent out, it actually has the idea to hurl. So I want you to imagine, okay, so we just had the baseball season wrap up. I want you to imagine the pitcher's on that mound, okay, takes the call, and the 98 mile an hour fastball comes down 60 feet 6 inches. This is the imagery that we have here in verse 4. That the Lord, it's almost as he's that pitcher, he's got that hurricane wrapped up there in like a corkscrew ball, and he's going to whip that thing down into the ocean on the ship that Jonah is in. So it's a very violent sort of wording there when it says it was sent out. It means to hurl forth. And what God was hurling forth was a hurricane. And the effect of it is found in verse 5. See Jonah 1 verse 5. The mariners were afraid and cried every man unto his God. So here we have seasoned sailors. I know you have a lot of rivers here in Pittsburgh. But you have a lot of sailors. I don't know. Any sailors? Maybe a head nod if there is a sailor here. I haven't spent a lot of time on boats. I have spent a little bit of time. Not sort of like our eastern cousins in Canada, the Newfies. But if you ever talked to a fisherman or a sailor, they're a different breed, aren't they? I had the pleasure to go to Newfoundland, I think it was 2012, 4 years ago. And we sort of went from these little pockets on the island of Newfoundland. And they would tell you these stories about being hundreds of miles outside of sea and international waters that are doing their fishing. And there's sort of a toughness about them, you know? There's a very sort of a leathery face and very rugged, and you hardly understand what they're saying. But there's a sort of a way of life to them that was so different from our way of life, you know, in the suburbs. But here's these mariners in verse 5. And this storm is so unique upon the waters of the Mediterranean that it says in verse 5 that they were afraid and cried every man unto his God. So here's these seasoned sailors, these seasoned mariners, there in the sea, and the waves are sort of buffeting the boat. There's a saying in sailing, and it goes like this. Waves are not measured in feet or inches. Waves are measured in increments of fear. And so you see to a sailor, you know, he can look at a 20-foot swell and say, oh, our boat can handle that. Our ship will stay afloat. But when something sort of grander comes, you know, on the sort of horizon line there, and it causes these mariners to be afraid and gripped by what they're seeing, this is special. This is different. And I remember there was an incident when I was with my father and my brother. We were out fishing in a big lake. It was a while ago. We didn't have a power boat or anything. It was just a simple rowboat. And I remember seeing off in the sort of the horizon, the storm sort of coming in. But we were a considerable distance from the shoreline. And I remember very distinctly, the storm rolled in, thunder, lightning, torrential downpour. You know, my dad, my brother and I was about 9 years old. And I'll never forget, because my dad was furiously rowing to get us back to the shoreline. The waves were buffeting, the wind, it seemed like, you know, every row we were sort of going, you know, one step forward and two steps back. And I remember seeing my brother beside me and just bawling his eyes out and just terrified and gripping onto me and the life jacket and just hoping that we'd make it back to shore. And then I looked at my father. You see, I can understand why my little brother was petrified. But I looked at my father. He was petrified too. And I thought, if he's petrified, then we're in big trouble. Obviously, we have made it. We made it back to shore. But I'll never forget the face, you know, that my father had. He knew the situation. It was not necessarily life or death, but we were not in a good position. And so here's these mariners, and they're afraid of what they're seeing. So much afraid that you see what it says in verse 5 of Jonah 1, that they cried, every man, to his God. So you have to just imagine, you know, here's the mariners on the boat, and they're being buffeted, and please, oh, this God, and, oh, please, and this God. You know, any God that will do, anyone that will save us out of this great hurricane. So here's these mariners, and they're just praying, pleading with anything to save them. Now, do you notice what it says in verse 5? It says they pray to God, their God. That's a spiritual move. Didn't work. And what do they do next? It says after they pray to their God, and they cast forth the wares that were in the ship into the sea to lighten it of them. And isn't this how man works? First, I'll try God. Doesn't answer me. I'm going to take it into my own hands. I'm going to fix this situation myself. It's exactly what happens. They try God, no answer. Okay, I'm going to do something about it myself. Where's the faith in that? And you see, what can happen as well, brothers and sisters, young people, is we can be in some sort of situation in our own lives. We pray to God. We pray to God again. Pray to Him again. Seemingly He's doing nothing. So what do? Rather than pray to God again, we try and rectify the situation with human means. You see, it's no different in the world. This is how they act. But see, when we sort of take up that step process, really we have to sort of strengthen our faith and our resolve and be patient that God will bring about a delivery from that situation. And so while this is all going on, you see, they're casting out the wares of the ship to lighten it of them. But you see what it says in verse 5? But Jonah has gone down to the sides of the ship, and he lay and was fast asleep. You know, you read that verse and you think, how could you be sleeping in the middle of a hurricane? If you've ever been in a hurricane, that's probably the last thing you would ever do, is probably sleep. You see, Jonah is so spiritually drained that it has drained his energy. You know, the decision which he has made to give up his prophetic office, to jeopardize his spiritual salvation, to now be found in this situation on the boat, he can't do anything but sleep. Now, you ever been woken up rudely? You have someone come in and say, oh, time to get up. Curtains go this way and that way. Flip, light switch on. Sometimes, if necessary, glass of water on the face. Now, look what happens in verse 6. All this is going on the deck of the ship. You know, these mariners are praying to this god, that god, throwing this thing over the overboard, and Jonah's down asleep. So verse 6, it says, so the shipmaster came to Jonah and said unto him, what are you doing? He says, what meanest thou, O sleeper? Arise, call upon thy God, if so be that God will think upon us that we perish not. You can just imagine, you know, it's not that sort of peaceful. You know, he gets up from his long nap. It's a, what's going on? And Jonah's awake, and he's now being prodded into action. But did you notice what the shipmaster told him to do? Two things. And I think this would have arrested the attention of Jonah, because you see what it says in verse 6. The shipmaster barges into the confines of Jonah's sleeping environment and says, what meanest thou, O sleeper? Arise and call. Now, where have we seen that before? Already in Jonah chapter 1. And you see, we've already seen that in verse 2. Because these are the exact same words that God said to Jonah. In Jonah 1 and verse 2, when it says, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it. And so isn't that funny? Because Jonah thought he had fled from the presence of the Lord. He had found the furthest place he could go to in Tarshish. He found a ship. He even tucked himself in the side of that ship, thinking that he had escaped the very presence of God. And he falls asleep. And the very next words he hears, as he's startled out of that slumber in verse 6, is arise and call. You see, now Jonah, his attention is going to be arrested by what he's actually done, what he's actually put himself in, and by extension, these mariners upon the boat. Now, when it says that Jonah was fast asleep, you see there at the end of verse 5, that Jonah was fast asleep. I want you to come with me to Judges, the book of Judges, chapter 4. This is the type of sleep that Jonah was in before he was awoken by the shipmaster. So in Jonah 1 verse 5, it says that he was fast asleep. Now that word is actually used here in Judges chapter 4, in the account of Barak and Deborah when they were fighting Sisera. So Judges chapter 4, verse 20, Jael has entered the scene, and Sisera is looking for a place of refuge. It says in verse 20 of Judges 4, again, Sisera said unto Jael, stand in the door of the tent, and it shall be when any man doth come and inquire of thee, and say, is there any man here? Thou shalt say, no. Judges 4, verse 21. Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a nail of the tent, took a hammer in her hand, and went softly unto him, and smote the nail into his temples, and fastened it into the ground. For he was, and here's our word, fast asleep and weary. And so he died. And so when it says there of Sisera, after all the actions of that day, the battle, lighting off his chariot, sprinting for cover, finding a tent, he's exhausted. He basically plummets into the tent. If anyone says there's a man here, you say no. And he's just overblown with lack of energy. When it says that he was fast asleep in verse 21 of Judges 4, it's the same word spoken of Jonah in Jonah chapter 1 and verse 5. And so when we come back to Jonah, we sort of have sort of a little exhortation, as it were. It's more energy to not do the commandments of God than to do them. So I'll say that again. It's more energy to not do the commandments of God than to do them. So there's something that God wants us to do, and we say no. And then the whole time, there's a conscious pricking And the taxation of our mind and our spiritual energy goes way down, way, way, way down. But if we had just done what God asked us to, we'd move through it and take further steps towards God's kingdom. But you see, when we're like Jonah and we decide we're not going to do what God wants us to, there's an anxiety that exists in our head. And the stresses of not being right with God. You see, this was taxing on Jonah, so much so that it was as if he was in a literal slumber and he needed to be arrested his attention and so he could arise out of sleep, because not only physically but mentally, but spiritually, Jonah's energy was sapped. And then it says in verse 7, Jonah gets buffeted up to the deck of the ship. And I think Jonah would have known he was caught. You see what it says in verse 7? They said, "Everyone to his fellow, come, let us cast lots, that we may know for whose cause this evil is upon us." And so they cast lots, and the lot fell upon Jonah. Now, a lot is sort of, you know, a couple stones perhaps, and they sort of roll them, and they sort of fall where they may, and based on the positions of what's facing upwards, that's the decision of the lot. You know, we sort of roll a piece of you know, some dice, so we sort of get the sense, and that's fine. But try rolling a lot on the deck of a ship in the middle of a hurricane, and they land at Jonah. And what's Jonah going to think? I've found out. But I want you to think about this for a second. So they say, we're going to cast lots, and there's a bunch of us on this ship, and we're going to find out who's at fault and why this hurricane is upon us. What were Jonah's options at that very moment? And think about it for a second. Could not Jonah have just said, you don't have to worry about the lots. I'm pretty sure the issue's with me. You know, Jonah could have, you know, been honest and said, you know, don't bother going through all the rigmarole of, you know, finding out whose it's going to be, getting down to the last one of us. I can tell you, I'm pretty confident that it's actually me. And that would have been the right thing to do. But Jonah doesn't do that. Because you know what? I think Jonah had, in his mind, an example of an individual found in Joshua chapter 7. So if you come with me to Joshua 7... I think Jonah thought about this particular individual in the history of Israel. And we know him as Achan, another individual who troubled others. You see, in Joshua chapter 7, they've gone in, they were told not to take up the accursed thing in Jericho. And they lost the battle at their next city, which was Ai. And so God approaches unto Joshua. And it says in Joshua 7, verse 16, "Joshua rose up early in the morning and brought Israel by their tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken." So the angel said to Joshua, here's how you're going to find out who the culprit is who is taken of the accursed thing. You're going to cast lots. So in verse 16, it says that they brought Israel by their tribes, and the tribe of Judah was taken. So one of 12. And I want you to remember, the whole time that this is going on, there's one individual in that encampment who knows who took the accursed thing. Verse 17. Joshua brought the family of Judah. He took the family of the Zerites. He brought the family of the Zerites, man by man. And Zabdi was taken. So now we're whittling down even out of the tribe, even into a family, and even into a man. Verse 18. And he brought his household, man by man, and Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, was taken. You know what's remarkable here? That in the life of Achan, here's the lots being cast, and then a parcel of individuals go away. And another lot is cast, and a smaller parcel of individuals has gone away. And another lot is cast, and a smaller parcel of individuals has gone away. And who's standing there the entire time? And he knows who that lot is seeking out. And it's Achan. But what doesn't Achan do? doesn't say to Joshua, I'm the one you're looking for. And you see what happens there in Joshua chapter 7, verse 19. Joshua said unto Achan, my son, give, I pray thee, glory to the Lord God of Israel, and make confession unto him. Tell me now what thou hast done. Hide it not from me. And you see, brothers and sisters, young people, when we come back to Jonah, I think Jonah thought that there was no way that that particular lot would fall upon him. But you see, God was giving Jonah an opportunity to step forward and to do the right thing. To take the opportunity before the lot actually fell at his feet. Because you see there in Jonah chapter 1 and verse 7 at the very end, so they cast lots and the lot fell upon Jonah. You see, I think the lesson is there might be something in our own lives, brothers and sisters and young people, and it might be different depending on who we are. There might be something in our lives where God is consistently casting a lot. And each time it gets more and more and more pertinent. And God is saying, take this opportunity to be honest. Step forward and make confession. Because here's the scary thing. If we've got that something, and Christ comes back today, it's too late to make confession at the judgment seat. You see, right now, when the lot is being cast in our own lives, God is saying, step forward and make your confession. Jonah thought that God would not find him out. And he did. And you see, God was going to do that to Jonah because Jonah was to arise and cry against Nineveh, but he fled from the presence of the Lord. He wouldn't open his mouth and offer salvation to whom he thought didn't deserve it. And then God's going to hurl out a hurricane against the ship. And they're going to try and determine who it was that's responsible for this. And then this lot on the deck of that ship as it's being buffeted lands squarely at Jonah. And it's for one reason and one reason only. It's so that Jonah can make his confession. And God willing, the words of his confession, we're going to look at in our second class.